This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's a truth known to dieters the world over. And as of this week, it's been proven in the lab. It really does take some people more effort, more calorie cutting, more laps around the track to drop the same number of pounds as their similarly overweight neighbors. Shake your fist at those skinny minis all you want, but that's biology for you. Joining me now to talk about that finding, as well as other selected short subjects in science, is Virginia Hughes. She's science editor at the BuzzFeed News, and she joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this weight loss idea. So, is the game rigged against some people?
Yeah, you know, you always hear that weight loss is about calories in and calories out, and all you have to do is make sure you cut down on your food and increase your exercise. And that's true, but of course, as you said, everybody knows it's more complicated than that. So, this new study that came out this week really precisely measured the food intake and the exercise energy output of 12 obese people over many weeks. This was an NIH study, and these people came into the NIH campus in sort of like hotel rooms, but their rooms were actually these very specialized chambers that can measure people's breathing. And by measuring kind of the air chemistry, they can figure out what their metabolic rate is. So they brought these folks in. They put them on a very extreme diet. They had to drink Ensure, that kind of
liquid diet.
So they had to the Ensure diet for 6 weeks, which reduced their calorie intake by 50%. And you can imagine that they all lost weight on this diet, but some of them lost a lot more weight than others. So some lost 5% of their body weight, and others lost up to 12% of their body weight. So basically what happens when you reduce your calories like that, your metabolism slows down. That's like a natural response of your body. But some people's metabolism slows down a lot more than others. So the researchers called those people the thrifty metabolism type. One of the researchers said, weight loss is one situation where being thrifty doesn't pay.
And that is something we all knew, right? I'm working out. I'm getting nowhere. Somebody's doing the same thing and losing a lot of weight.
Yeah, they're really
hardwired.
They're pushing for a more personalized approach to weight loss. You know, not everyone is going to benefit from cutting calories as much as everybody else.
Mm. Now, tell us about the story you have about a new approach to disease research.
Yeah, this week, this is all about public-private collaborations in medical research, which we're going to see more and more of, I hear, especially as the federal government continues to drop its own investment in biomedical research. So this week, GlaxoSmithKline, GSK, which is this giant pharmaceutical company in the UK, it teamed up with a public university, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And they created a new company together. Mm. And this new company called Cura, with a Q, has a goal of not only treating but curing HIV. So this is a pretty big deal. Like, you know, universities and pharma have all kinds of collaborations. That's not really new. But to start a new company together and split all future profits 50-50 is probably never been done before.
So instead of the researchers doing the basic research at the beginning and then looking for a company, they start out right at the beginning.
Yeah, so the idea is to combine these two very different cultures. Usually you think of academic researchers as being, you know, they have eureka findings in the lab, very basic research. There's a lot of trial and error and serendipity. And then you think of industry researchers as being all about standardizing, scaling things up, all about how do we take this discovery and turn it into a commercial, profitable product. And so the idea is to combine these things together from the get-go and hopefully save a lot of time and make more money ultimately.
Yeah, we'll see how that works out.
Yeah.
You've also got some bad news for bees again.
Again. I'm sure you guys have talked about the poor bees a lot on this show.
We have. My brother is a beekeeper, so I'm always up on the latest news
about
bees.
Oh, wow.
So I'm interested.
So yeah, this week a big survey came out on Wednesday. It was a survey of beekeepers over the last year. And they've reported losing 42% of their colonies this year, which is a lot. It's wow. actually a big drop even from the previous year, which was 34%. So,
is that across the board? Is that the same as the commercial people versus, you know, the big commercial beekeepers versus the smaller
yeah.
individual beekeepers?
So the trend is the same. Yeah, even though only 5% of the, there was about 5,000 beekeepers surveyed, and I think only 5% were commercial. But that 5% of commercial beekeepers do the vast majority, you know, have right. the vast majority of the bees. So the trends are the same for both. And of course, nobody knows why. It's this big, sad mystery.
So sort of a constellation of things they think are going wrong.
Yeah.
Right?
So one thing that is new about this survey, one new finding, is that this is the first time that they seem to have lost more bees in the summer than the winter, which is really surprising because the winter is when it gets cold and when they have a lot of problems with nutrition. And so this is a big question mark of why this is happening over the summer. Some people say crop prices are going up. And so with more crops being planted, wildflowers and wild trees that bees would use to for food are being, there's fewer of them. And so maybe it's about nutrition. Huh. That's one possibility. Could be pesticides.
You know, the nicotinoids, as they're called, that sort of thing. They've talked about that.
Yeah. And then the mites, too, the parasites could be that, too. Although they said that commercial beekeepers don't usually have the parasites. They usually have those under control. So, yeah, it's really important to us. I read in one of the articles that bees are worth at least $10 billion a year in the pollination services. That's
they
amazing.
A lot of stuff.
Little bees, that much money.
We have to take care of them. One quick story of a quirky story about a very pricey jar of peanut butter.
So, Ira, would you pay $254 for a jar of peanut butter? Six ounces.
I won't pay that for my glasses.
Yeah. So it's actually a very important jar of peanut butter, though. So this is sort of an update of an old story. In 2003, a section of the Commerce Department called the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, they put out 2,800 of these small jars of peanut butter and started selling them. And so far, 80% of those have been sold. So you can still buy one if you want.
What's so special about these jars? Are these like the, you know, the standard you have for a pound? This is what it should be? The standard for what peanut butter should be?
Yeah, this is the standard, you know, according to the U.S. government, this is the standard peanut butter. So the idea is that food companies and scientists and government scientists want this reference standard. So they can know in this jar, they know exactly how much protein, carbohydrate, and fat is there. They can calibrate all their equipment and make sure that their measurements are completely precise.
Jars out there. How much is it now?
$254. It's apparently very, very sticky. Sticks to the roof of your mouth.
We'll talk about why it lasts forever. So, thank you, Virginia.
Thanks.
Virginia Yu, science editor at BuzzFeed, to hear it on New York Studios. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Today is Endangered Species Day. Did you know that? Congress created in 2006 to celebrate wildlife and raise awareness about threatened species in the U.S. And when it comes to species on the decline, conservationists seem to have a handle on what to do. But what about when these things work? When the species that is endangered actually comes back, like humpback whales, or they're on the mend. Is it time to kick them off the endangered species list? Joe Roman has a new paper in the journal Trends in Ecology and Evolution that tackles this very issue. He's a conservation biologist at Harvard, back on Science Friday to talk about the pros and cons of delisting species. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure.
All right, Joe, good news.
Good news. Well, you just get opened up with it, Ira. Humpback whales are doing phenomenally well in most of the oceans right now. In the North Pacific, they were probably down to about 1,000, maybe 1,500 individuals in the 1960s. In that area off of Alaska and Hawaii, we now have more than 21,000 individuals. And that we're seeing patterns like that through many of the populations around the world, including here on the Atlantic. So we may now have about 60,000 30,000 humpback whales. And as you had mentioned, we're considering taking them off the list now. The National Marine Fisheries Service is thinking, okay, let's consider these recovered. If we look at the IUCN Red List, the sort of international body that considers these things, they don't consider them threatened anymore. Mm. So that's the great news for humpback whales. And we can see that for a lot of for several other species as well that are currently listed.
So what's the bad thing?
Well, the bad thing is that occasionally these delistings are not occurring because of the using the best available science. So let's look at the Rocky Mountain gray wolf, for example. It was reintroduced to Yellowstone and Idaho in the 1990s. Populations bounced back, and they're now up to about 1,600 individuals, and their range is expanding. It was delisted in around 2007 and has since been moving back. Then it was relisted, listed, delisted, moving back between the courts until it ended up in Congress, who delisted it with a rider to a budget bill. Basically, not using the best available science, but using politics there. That's what we don't want to do. We want listing decisions and delisting decisions to be determined by the number of species and the best available science. Mm. For example, the Oregon chub is a fish, freshwater fish, found in Oregon, of course. Populations there were down to 1,000 when it was first listed, and there are now about 140,000 in the wild in 80 lakes. So there's a clear evidence ready to delist. Let's take them off. It's when we have business interests or politics making those decisions that we get concerned.
Yeah, we got about a minute left. Is there a middle ground here between all those concerns we could arrive at?
I think the ESA does try and do, the Endangered Species Act does try and look for a middle ground. It says, of course, that we can't consider economics when we are in protecting species. They're either endangered or they're not, but we do make some decisions on habitat and how we protect habitat. Yeah. Wow. So I think the most important thing is we look at the scientific data and then you look at the social impacts. I would say one of the important things we can do is encourage people to become familiar with the historical baselines of these species.
Right.
They used to be very abundant.
All right, Joe, I have to cut you off, and thank you for taking time to be with us today. Joe, a Roman conservation biologist at Harvard. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about how to clone a woolly mammoth. It's not as easy as you think. We'll tell you how to do it with a how-to after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last month, researchers at the Swedish Museum of Natural History announced they had sequenced not one, but two woolly mammoth genomes. Scientists sleuthed out all those A, T, Gs, Cs from bits of 44,000-year-old mammoth tissue and a 4,000-year-old molar. The imagination runs a little wild thinking about what all that genetic information could add up to. Could mammoths roam the earth once more? There's at least one Russian scientist who thinks so. He's founded a Siberian nature reserve. He's waiting for revived woolies to call it home. Just imagine a family vacation to Pleistocene Park. Well, my next guest is here to bring us back down to earth. She's an expert in the field of ancient DNA, and she says so-called de-extinction is a lot harder than you make it look in Jurassic Park. Before we see our first baby woolies, she says we've got some big questions to answer. Like, why should we be bringing extinct species back in the first place? If you'd like to talk about it, you can phone us in at 844-724-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Beth Shapiro is an associate professor of ecology and evolutionary biology, University of California, Santa Cruz. Her new book is called How to Clone a Mammoth, The Science of De-Extinction. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you. So why bring back woolly mammoths in the first place?
That's,
I know it's really cool to
question.
See them. We'd all like to see them, but like to see a lot of things.
Exactly. So I ask that question a lot when I talk to people about bringing species back to life. Not everyone wants a woolly mammoth to come back, and not everyone chooses a woolly mammoth as their first object of potential resurrection. But it seems to be really popular, and I think the reason really is because we feel safe about them. We're pretty sure that woolly mammoths aren't going to eat us. And maybe we feel a little bit guilty about potentially having done a little bit to drive them to extinction in the first place. But I don't think that guilt is really a good reason to consider resurrecting a species. What kind of good reasons might there be? Well, I think there might be a variety. There are some scientific reasons. Maybe different species might have unique traits that we'd like to be able to study or examine or try to understand the genetic underpinning of. Or maybe extinct species actually performed a really important pivotal role in an ecosystem, and their absence has somehow thrown that ecosystem out of whack and left it in a place where other species are now in danger of going extinct. There are many different reasons that one might consider doing this. That doesn't mean that it's possible or a good idea in all cases.
Mm-hmm. And de-extinction isn't going to be cheap, right?
Cheap, no. The cost of this, there's many costs, of financial costs, and then there's actually ethical considerations to keep in mind when we're doing this. I think for every species that we want to consider, that someone might consider for bringing back to life, there are different technical hurdles that one would have to overcome, and all of these are things that technology will still need to be developed in order to create. One of the main challenges of bringing extinct species back to life is in the word cloning itself. Cloning is actually a very specific scientific technique. It's the technology that brought us Dolly the sheep in the mid-1990s. And it requires something that most extinct species and all extinct species that have been gone for quite some time don't have, and that is a living cell.
Yeah.
Without a living cell, it's not possible to clone using this technology a species. So there are a multitude of other technical challenges that will need to be met before it could happen.
Mm-hmm. Is there another way to bring the mammoths back if we're not going to do it the conventional way? Using the genome?
Yeah,
do we know what the mammoth genome is?
Exactly. Yeah. Using the genome. Now that we have this very long sequence of A, C's, G's, and T's, mammoth genomes are about 4 billion plus A, C's, G's, and T's long. And we have quite a lot of those. So let's say we know most of those. The other thing that we know is that an Asian elephant, the living species that is the mammoth's closest relative, diverged from mammoths only about 6 or so million years ago. And their genome sequences are already 99% identical. So we have a 99% mammoth already in an Asian elephant. So the idea that most people are discussing these days is to use genome engineering, genome editing technologies to basically cut and paste our way the rest of the way to that 100% and get to a mammoth genome sequence, starting with a living Asian elephant.
But would you have a true mammoth if you started with the elephant? Would you have all the genes there that makes a mammoth, or you're going to have mostly an elephant? If I can't get the words together.
Yeah, I think you would have a hybrid. You'd definitely have a hybrid. And it's not just the genome sequence. You know, we could look at a whole bunch of genomes from Asian elephants and a whole bunch of genomes from mammoths and identify which genes, Asian elephants look like one thing, mammoths look like something else, they're different from each other, and then make a list of the genes we wanted to swap out, the elephant version for the mammoth version of those genes. And even if we were to do that, to have something whose genome is nearly 100% mammoth-like, it would still have to go through the process of being born, and it would have to develop within the body of an elephant. It would have to be raised by elephants in the company of elephants, and we're knowing more and more every day about how our environment, the influences around us outside of our genome, actually affect the way we end up looking and acting. A lot of this we can learn from identical twin studies. If we see identical twins that are in their 70s and 80s, sometimes they don't even look like they're related to each other anymore, and these differences, these physical differences between them, are because of the different stresses in their environment, the different foods they've eaten, the different experiences that they've had. And the same would definitely be true for a mammoth that was developed inside the body of a female elephant and then was raised by elephants and consumed an elephant's diet. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is any way that we could ever come back with ever recreate something that was 100% identical to a species that's extinct.
Is that true even of the passenger pigeon genome? Your lab pieced together that genome, and there's a lot of people don't realize how many passenger pigeons. There used to be billions of them in America, and they were hunted down. And there is an effort at trying to bring back the passenger pigeon, isn't there?
Well, there's an effort to think about whether it might be possible to bring back the passenger pigeon. I say yes, there are people in this world who believe that it would be great to reinstate passenger pigeons. I'm not convinced. Passenger pigeons went extinct 100 years ago. When Europeans first arrived in North America, these birds would flock in the billions of individuals, darken the daytime sky for days at a time. I'm not convinced that there is a place to put passenger pigeons if we were to bring them back. And there are other technical hurdles associated with doing this kind of work with birds. One can't clone birds. One can't actually go through that process of, once you have a developing embryo, sticking it inside some surrogate egg or surrogate host to bring that embryo to term, to be a full-bodied animal. So there would be other ways that one would have to genetically engineer birds. But for passenger pigeons, I'm not convinced there's a reason to do it, or a way that we could actually create a bird that we could then release into the environment and have it thrive in the wild.
Something not as sexy about a passenger pigeon is as there is about a woolly mammoth.
That's true. And I really think that the only reason people choose a woolly mammoth, and that is the most common animal that people choose, is because they know it's not possible to clone dinosaurs.
That's right. Not yet. No, I'm not going to even go there. Let's go. Rather, I'm going to the phones. Let somebody else sound silly instead of me. Let's go to Allentown, PA. Anthony, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So I was curious. In the evolving forefront of science, there's been a lot of talk about microflora and bacteria evolving in commensal relationships with organisms. Like, we have many, many bacteria within our gut that are crucial to keeping us alive and operating. As we talk about bringing back these extinct species, is there any risk not only of maybe not bringing back the bacteria that was natural to them, but spawning a location where bacteria that may not have favorable conditions to grow in the modern-day setting might find a new location and grow in ways that are unpredictable?
Yeah, the microbiome.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things to consider when you think about the microbiome. There's obviously an important interaction between an organism and the microbiome within it. We know that in elephants, the newborn elephants will often consume the poo of their mom in order to instantiate that population of bacteria or microorganisms that live in their gut and allow them to actually consume the diet that they eat. And we don't have that. We don't have a record of what that is from mammoths. We do have some mummified remains of mammoths that include intestinal content samples that we can sequence and try to see what the bacterial community of a mammoth might have looked like. But when we extract DNA from something that's been buried in the dirt for a long time, we get not only the DNA from that, from in this case the intestinal contents and also mammoth DNA, but also DNA that just lives in the soil regularly. And it's very hard to take those apart and figure out what is host DNA and what is the microbiome of a mammoth versus what is just stuff that got into that sample while it was buried in the soil. Mm-hmm. We don't know how important the correct microbiome might be. But, you know, it probably is important, and that's going to be another thing that kind of holds us back from creating something that's 100% identical to a species that used to be alive.
Let's go to Castro Valley, California. Cheryl, is it Castro Valley or Castroville?
Castro Valley.
Hi. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, assuming we can bring the extinct these creatures beyond the point of why, what place are they going to have in our current ecosystem? Will they be able to sustain themselves? And what will they do to the already existing competitors?
Good question, Cheryl.
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, and one that I do think about in some detail in my book and talk about. You know, when we think about bringing extinct species back to life and what species we might want to bring back to life, one of the first things we have to know is why they went extinct in the first place and whether we've solved that problem that caused them to go extinct in the first place. Otherwise, if we were to release them into the environment, they might simply go extinct once again. And then also, ecosystems are not static. They're always changing. And when a species goes extinct, the ecosystem will change and adapt to the absence of that organism. Other species might come in, or the ecosystem might change entirely. And it's very clear that if we were to release a species into a habitat in which it hasn't been for many thousands of years, it will definitely affect the other organisms that live there. I think the only way way that we can really investigate this is to perform as detailed a risk assessment as we can, but with the knowledge that we will never be able to predict every consequence of introducing a species into the wild, just like we can't predict the consequences of invasive species getting into a habitat. The reason that I advocate for this, for at least thinking about using this technology, despite that it is definitely risky, is that we are living in an environment where there are species that are going extinct and habitats that are being destroyed at an alarming rate. And it's clear that the steps that we've been able to take so far to try to preserve habitats and keep species from going extinct are not working. We do have some successes. I heard about humpback whales in a previous segment, but most species that are on the endangered species list are not going to get off the endangered species list. And this might not be the right solution for many species, but it certainly is a potentially powerful tool for helping to combat biodiversity loss in the present day.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you just joined us, we're talking about how to clone a mammoth, the science of de-extinction, with Beth Shapiro. So you're saying that we should go ahead and try to master this technique because, if nothing else, the species that are dying out amongst us now.
I think that this technology is a potentially powerful tool to help to conserve species that are alive today, not just to bring species that are extinct back to life. In fact, it might be better used to help to preserve species that are alive today. One of the species that I often talk about is the black-footed ferret. Black-footed ferrets are endangered across the American plains. They nearly went extinct a couple of decades ago. There was an extermination program, and one small isolated population did manage to survive. But that population is nearly genetically identical. Every individual in that population has almost the same DNA. And now there's a disease that's killing them that they can't fight. And one potential use of this genome editing technology might be to just identify genes in museum populations of black-footed ferrets or in black-footed ferrets from a couple decades ago that are preserved with tissue culture and cells intact at the San Diego Zoo, the frozen zoo in the San Diego Zoo, and identify the parts of the genomes from those black-footed ferrets that provide some resistance to disease. And then you could use this same technology of swapping out genes that we might do to turn an elephant cell into a mammoth cell to increase the diversity at these immune resistance genes in living populations of black-footed ferrets.
I'm running out of time, so I'm trying to get to the related questions. Let's talk about cloning then. I mean, is that what you're talking about here? Are there projects going on out there to bring species back through cloning? Could you do this through cloning?
It's not the same thing as cloning. It's using the cloning technology. So you do have to create embryos and go through the process of cloning eventually. But it's first using this genome editing technology, swapping out bits of the genome for DNA sequences that we get from individuals that aren't alive anymore. In this case, black-footed ferrets that died 50 years ago or 100 years ago. But in the case of elephants, for example, what if we could make elephants somewhat more cold tolerant by swapping genes into elephants that mammoths had that allowed mammoths to adapt to living and surviving in a cold environment? Could we use that technology then to expand the range of habitat that elephants could live in?
Let me ask you about the Bucardo in Spain. Tell us about that.
The Bucardo is an ibex, a type of mountain goat that lived in the Pyrenees and went extinct in the early 2000s. Before the Bucardo went extinct, the scientists involved in the project, a team of Spanish and French scientists, they managed to trap the last living individual, Celia, and collected a few samples, a little bit of tissue from her without injuring her in any way, and then released her back into the wild for her lonely life as the last living Bucardo. And then they had these tissue samples that they could use to try to clone her using the traditional method of cloning, taking a tissue cell and somehow coaxing that cell to revert to the type of cell that was capable of becoming an entire organism.
Were they successful with this?
They managed to create many embryos, and one of them was eventually born. This individual only lived for 10 minutes. It had a massive lung deformity and wasn't able to breathe, so it didn't survive. But there's no way to know whether or not that lung deformity was because of the cloning process or just simply something that happens sometimes during pregnancy and development.
To try it a few more times then. Thank you, Beth. Beth Shapiro, Associate Professor of Ecology, Evolutionary Biology at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her new book, How to Clone a Mammoth, The Science of De-Extinction. Very interesting reading, Beth.
And thank you.
Good luck to you. And thank you for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break. When we come back, up next, your local weather forecast, if by local you mean within 92 million miles, you know, the distance to the sun. We'll tell you why that's important after this break, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Next week is Solar Week, celebrating the Sun-Earth connection in your classroom. So it's probably just a coincidence that NASA's Solar Dynamics Observatory spotted a massive solar flare rated at class X2.7 erupting from the surface of the Earth. X means it's the most intensive type, with a 2, of course, twice as powerful as a 1. That intense flare was spotted earlier this month, and in the past weeks, astronomers have also been keeping an eye on a group of sunspots on the solar surface. Who better to get a handle on the solar activity, explain what the sun does, than sun specialist Alex Young. He's Associate Director for Science in the Heliophysics Division at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. He also blogs about solar activity at The Sun Today. He joins us from NASA campus in Greenbelt, Maryland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, it's good to talk to you.
Good to have you with us. Tell us about this recent big flare. What's so special about it or scary about it?
Well, as you mentioned, we have this rating system that's much like the way that we rate earthquakes on a scale that's logarithmic and powers of 10. And the biggest on our scale is the X flare. And on the 5th of May, there was a sunspot just starting to rotate into view on the edge of the sun. And all of a sudden, it popped off this nice, big, bright explosion and sent off huge amounts of X-rays and ultraviolet light, as well as lots of material and particles. And we call that eruption a solar flare. This was a solar flare, and it also had this associated thing called a coronal mass ejection. And it was a relatively big one. It's pretty bright and spectacular, and it always gets our attention when it does that.
Do they always come from sunspots?
Well, eruptions don't just come from sunspots, but they do primarily come from sunspots. Sunspots are these areas of really, really high concentrations of magnetic field that have a lot of energy stored up in them. And so sometimes they want to get rid of that, and that's one of the things that we see. We do have other things on the sun, such as something called a filament, also a prominence, depending on if you look at it on the sun or the edge. And that's this big, long ropes of solar material held together with magnetic fields. And those sometimes can fly away and also give us these coronal mass ejections.
We're talking about the sun. If you'd like, there's so many fascinating things about the sun. I mean, I've been following this for my whole life and learned something new all the time. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. One of the most fascinating things that I learned as a youngster that just blew my mind, and maybe I'm hoping it's still true, is that there's a fusion going on inside, right? The ongoing nuclear fusion that's powering the sun inside and creating the sunlight. But that it takes how many years for the sunlight to get from the inside to the outside?
Somewhere on the order of about 100,000 years. Just an amazing, amazing amount of time.
That is unbelievable. Even though we know that the sunlight or light travels at the speed of light, which is so fast, it still takes 100,000 years for it to get out of the sun.
I know, it's crazy. So as you mentioned, the sun is this giant ball of hydrogen that's pressed so tightly in the center by gravity, and there's so much of it. The fusion is a very rare thing to happen, but because there's so much stuff there, it fuses into helium, gives off incredible amounts of energy, and gives off gamma rays. These gamma rays fly around inside the sun. They sort of rattle around. and work their way out. And as they're working their way out, they get lower and lower energy, and eventually they get to the surface, and that's what we see. And that takes, you know, somewhere on the order of 100,000 years. They've got a long way to go and a lot of stuff to bounce through.
Huh. So it's sort of randomly bouncing around before it gets out.
Exactly.
Huh. And so then it takes 8 minutes, something like that, to get to Earth?
Yeah, it takes 8 minutes. You know, light is really fast, and at least on the scale of our solar system, it's only got about, you know, 100 million miles or so, 93 million miles to get here, and that takes 8 minutes.
Hmm. How much do we not know about what's still going on? Oh, I guess we don't know what we don't know, I guess.
Exactly. And, the inside of the sun is one of the more difficult areas. I mean, there's an awful lot we still don't understand. We look at the sun indirectly inside using a type of seismology we call helioseismology. We see the vibrations of the sun itself, and just like you can work backwards processing sound waves on Earth to see what's inside the Earth, you can do the same thing in the sun. And so we do see things moving around. We see these massive rivers of solar plasma, the material that the sun's made up of. And there's also all this stuff that flows to the surface, this magnetic field. And the thing that we most want to understand is magnetic fields, when they get all twisted up, and especially in a plasma, they can release that energy. And that's a process we call magnetic reconnection. It happens throughout the entire universe. So it's really critical to understand that. And that's one of the things that we're working hardest to understand. We just launched a mission called MMS, the Magnetospheric Multiscale Mission, which is using the Earth's magnetic field and the environment around it as a laboratory to study this process that happens everywhere.
Because it's lucky for us that we have. That's why we have life on Earth. We have a magnetic field that protects us from all this radiation that captures from the sun.
It's critical to our survival, and it's one of the more interesting things. Not every planet in the solar system has a magnetic field. And so in the process of understanding our own, we're also studying the other planets that have less or no magnetic field at all to understand the process, not only here on Earth now, but perhaps what's happening in the past, in the early Earth, what would happen in the future, and even what's happening on exoplanets. You know, if we study what's happening to the planets here and our planet, it gives us an insight into what's happening in planets throughout the universe and how easy can life form, and what are the requirements for a magnetic field, and how does space weather affect those other planets?
You talk about space weather. Why is there weather on the sun?
Well, the sun is a giant generator. So it's this giant ball of plasma, super, super heated gas, and it's also threaded with magnetic field. And because it spins not uniformly, much like the gaseous planets like Jupiter or Saturn, we call that differential rotation. It makes that magnetic field get all twisted up inside. It eventually pops out on the surface. We see the sunspots. But that twisting of the magnetic field, that builds up energy, and that energy has to go somewhere. And so when the energy eventually releases in the form of these various types of eruptions, that stuff is sent out into space. Lots of electromagnetic energy, magnetic fields, material, and that stuff travels through the solar system, and it interacts with everything that it comes across. And that whole bunch of things that are traveling through the solar system is what we call space weather.
Mm. Here's a tweet from Rebecca who says, how do we know what happened 10 days ago on the sun, speaking, I guess, on May 5th, this massive solar flare? I guess the flare doesn't travel as fast as the speed of light, right?
Well, in fact, it does, because the flare itself is a blast of light. Mm-hmm. So there are different things that can occur. There's an eruption, but there's the flash of light. That's the flare. And so that is traveling at the speed of light.
Well, how do we know to be ready for something like a day in advance that is coming to Earth?
That's a really hard problem. The only thing we can do is we can look at a sunspot and we see how complex is it, how much energy, potential energy is built up in it. And all we can do is look back at history and say, every time we've seen a sunspot like that before, we know that it gives off so many of these types of flares. And then we can just come up with a percentage. This is sort of how you do precipitation on the Earth. You look at the current conditions and say, well, in the past, I've seen it rain, you know, one out of 20 times, and then that's how you get a percentage. Mm. So it's unfortunately not the kind of accuracy that we would like. We just have to look at the conditions, and then based on the past, we can make predictions about what we expect to happen.
Do all those particles take, are they traveling at the speed of light too?
Well, those are slower. Now, there can be particles that are, we call ultra-relativistic, so they get very close to the speed of light, but not quite. So while the light takes about 8 minutes to get here, the particles, the fastest ones may get here in about 20 minutes, and then there'll be the stragglers that'll come along much later. But then the other part, that big blob, that cloud called the coronal mass ejection, that is much slower. That takes somewhere between 1, 2 to 4 days to get
here. I guess
here.
That's what I was talking about before when I was saying it takes some while for stuff to get
right
here. We know about it in advance.
Exactly.
And what are we so concerned about? What could that blob do to us?
Well, that blob is carrying not only kinetic energy, you know, the motion energy, but it also has magnetic field and plasma. And that magnetic field, when it gets to our Earth, the pressure of the cloud pushes our magnetic environment, our magnetosphere, but that magnetic field interacts with our Earth's magnet, and if the orientation is just right, energy is transferred into our magnetic environment, and that can generate all these electrical currents. Those currents give us some nice things like the aurora borealis, but they can disrupt communications. And in the most extreme situations, they can even cause power fluctuations in our grid. In the worst case, even take a grid out.
Let's go to the phones. Lots of people with calls. Kurt in Boulder. Hi, Kurt.
Hi.
Go ahead.
First time I've called in the last 5 years. I love your show.
Thank you.
My question is, how vulnerable? I mean, I've realized we're probably tremendously vulnerable to an electromagnetic pulse because we've got all these wonderful digital gadgets hooked to wires which serve as antennas to receive the pulse. And I'd like to know, one thing, how vulnerable are we? And two, do we have a quick alert system? I know that, they're going to shut down power plants if we see something coming to us, but I just want to hear about our vulnerability.
Good question. Thanks for listening.
Well, the good thing is that our personal electronics are not really vulnerable. This is not quite the same thing as an EMP like we hear about for a nuclear weapon. This is fluctuations in magnetic field. Now, it can affect things like GPS satellites and communications, generally high frequency. For the most part, the personal electronics and the things that we're interested in, it's not going to have any noticeable impact. Now, having said that, you know, it does affect things like aviation. They have to maybe reroute stuff if there's communication problems at the poles, that sort of thing. The power companies are quite aware of this, and they are prepared to take action to keep these types of events from having any sort of broad effect. We have, you know, in terms of an alert system, we have our sister agency, NOAA, which is monitoring space weather. It sends out alerts. They're very in tune with all of the various industries that are concerned about it. And so they monitor what's happening. We do the same thing at NASA. As a matter of fact, we're interested in the Earth because we're interested in all the satellites that are around the Earth, and as well as all of our satellites through the solar system. So that's one of the primary things that NASA is monitoring, as NOAA is monitoring the infrastructure here on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Now, we have these orbiting observatories like SOHO and SDO and other things that are looking at the sun from far away. Is it possible or even desirable, if you could do it, to send a probe directly into the sun?
You bet. And we know what? We're going to do it.
Or we're going to
come
do
pretty
it.
Close. Yeah, we're going to come really close.
Are they going to call it Icarus? No.
I think that's a perfect name. We're going to call it Solar Probe Plus, and that's what its name is. It's being developed. It's going to be an amazing mission because it's got some huge technological challenges, things like, you know, special shielding to handle the really harsh environment. But we're going to send this thing into space. We're going to use other planets to assist us gravitationally and slowly circle in. There'll be many, many orbits as it goes around the sun and gets closer and closer and closer. And eventually, it's going to drop down through the solar atmosphere, something on the order of about 9 solar radiuses. This is, let's see, that's going to be maybe around 10 million miles or so, but less than that, actually about 5 million miles. And it's going to go through and scoop up some of the solar atmosphere, take images, measure particles. And so we're really going to fly through and just kind of run our hands through the outer atmosphere of the sun.
So you're not going way deep into it?
Not going to go way deep. It wouldn't make it very far if we tried to get it down to the into the inside. The harsh radiation would pretty much wipe it out fairly quickly. So unfortunately,
When is this going to happen?
It's going to be in 2018. So it's not too far away.
Wow.
I remember when it first was talked about, that seemed like forever, but we're getting pretty close now.
Mm-hmm. And how long do you think it'll last when it gets there?
It's going to last for a while. I don't remember the exact amount, but it's not going to, you know, this is not a mission where we're just going to drop it in and it's just going to burn up. I mean, we're going to take some orbits and make measurements, and we'll also be making measurements on the way in. So, it won't last forever because it is going to be experiencing a pretty
harsh burn. I have about a minute left, but a lot of callers are asking about something called the Carrington event. Can you summarize what that was quickly?
Yeah. So in September 1859, it was a giant sunspot, and it was observed by a famous British astronomer, Carrington. It happened to be the first time that we observed a solar flare, and he noticed there was amazing aurora all over the world that were associated with that, and he was the person who made this connection. So this happened to be several giant CMEs, kind of the perfect storm. They one went through the solar system, swept the way clean, and then a giant one came after that, slammed into the Earth, and it created amazing geomagnetic storms. Aurora were seen all the way down to the equator. There are stories of cowboys in the West waking up in the middle of the night thinking that it was dawn. But even more interesting, the telegraph system all over the world experienced massive current surges through them. Sometimes even when they were not connected, they were still working.
They were chattering away with the sun.
This was the big one. This is one of those 150-year size storms.
All right, Alex, I've run out of time. Fascinating. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
Alex Young, Associate Director for Science in the Heliophysics Science Division at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt and co-founder of The Sun Today. A reminder, our science club is asking you to join their latest project, Explain the Sun. Can you do that? We don't just want Alex's explanation. We want yours. So head over to sciencefriday.com/scienceclub to find out how to join in our latest challenge. We call it Explain the Sun. We've got to run like the sun. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.